meeting will come to order.
No, we might just have to have a hearing in Russia.
Find a spot. Since this is our first time together, you may remember, those of you who've been here a while, normally the first committee started at 8:15. That 15 minutes makes all the difference in being ready to convene here. But I think I'd like to have us just go around and introduce members, if you would let us know what area of the state you represent, and staff, what your function is. We'll start with Representative Gunther.
I'm Bob Gunther from District 23A. Live in Fairmont. My district has 72 miles on the Iowa line, and so I can officially say you all can get by with it. And it's a pleasure to be here.
I'm Nels Pearson. I'm in Health District 26B, which covers Olmsted County, a large part of Olmsted County, and I do get a part of the city of Rockton.
I'm Jeremy Munson. I'm in House District 23B, which is Waseca, Watonwan, Le Sueur, and Blue Earth counties, southern Minnesota.
In your first term, I believe?
I was here last session, so this is my first full term. I was elected
just
in February.
Just don't get to know one another.
Right.
Chair and members, my name is Mary Mullen. I work in the House Research Department, and I work mainly on housing policy issues.
I'm Michael Howard, State Representative for District 50A in my first term. Serving Richfield and East Bloomington.
And as vice chair.
I'm Laura Taken-Holtze. I'll be the committee administrator.
And I'm Alice Hausman. I represent some communities in St. Paul and the cities of Falcon Heights, Lauderdale, and most of Roseville. And if you've been to the state fair, you've been in my district.
My name is Blake Wilcox, and I am the CLA for this committee.
Deb Dyson from House Research, and I'm covering the finance part of this committee, and then I also do capital investment and local government powers and duties.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ken Savory from the House Fiscal Analysis Department. I cover, obviously, housing finance, and I also cover higher education finance and agriculture finance.
Good morning. My name is Tama Tice. I represent District 14A, which is the west and south part of St. Cloud, St. Augusta, and Wade Park. And I will be the Republican lead on the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. I'm Tony Juergens, State Representative from 54B, just starting my second term. 54B is part of Hastings, or all of Hastings, part of Cottage Grove, Afton, Denmark Township, and Ninninger Township.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Frank Hornstein, District 61A, that's parts of downtown and southwest Minneapolis, and I'm starting my ninth term.
Morning, Mrs. Chair. I'm suffering from one of Minnesota's grave illnesses. So I'm sorry to be that way here. I know that that's one of those things to start session and be the breeder of horrid diseases, but I'll try to... I'll invite you to take space from me, and I'll try to keep my brain in tow here. I was a member last year for one session, and so I'm in my second session. Background is that I'm a 30 years I was a real estate broker in Rochester, Minnesota. So I was very interested in this committee, and I'm happy to be here.
Madam Chair, members, good morning. Robert Bierman, 57A. A lot of Apple Valley and a good part of Lakeville, and I am first term.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. I have something, too, so you should probably all stay away from me. My name is Kali Herr, and I represent 64A, and that's in St. Paul. I'm a first termer as well, and I'm excited to be here because my constituents really care about this.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee. I'm Peter Fisher. I represent 43A, which is Maplewood, White Bear Lake, Montemedi area. I'm in my fourth term, very interested in the committee. My regular job, I work at a homeless youth shelter in North Minneapolis, which I've been doing for the last 12 years.
And then we'll go up the inside.
I'm Liam Magstead. I'm an intern from McAllister College.
All right. And just returned to this country from the Netherlands, so sometime we'll find out what he learned about housing in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
My name is Jennifer Nelson. I'm the DFL researcher for this committee, and I also serve with capital investment and transportation.
Mark Nicely, Republican Caucus Research. I cover this committee and the Agriculture Committee.
And then we have pages who may or may not be permanently assigned, but if you just would introduce yourselves.
I'm Mercedes Johansson. I'm from Minneapolis. And I'm Chloe Burris. I'm from St. Paul.
And they're still hiring, so we don't know if you're permanently with us, but we're happy you're here. And we have a very special introduction today. If she would come to the table, along with the other staff who might want to be here, because we have the Commissioner of Minnesota Housing, who will introduce herself to the committee. Welcome. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jennifer Ho, and I'm the new Commissioner of Minnesota Housing. Today's day nine on the job. I am so excited to be the new commissioner. I told the rest of the cabinet I got the really, really good one, and I'm really excited to be at the agency. Just a quick word of background. I spent a lot of time up here between 2000 and 2009. I was the executive director of Hearth Connection and worked with the Health and Human Services Committee to create the Supportive Housing and Managed Care Pilot and to create the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Service Fund. At Hearth Connection, we created a network of supportive housing providers that housed over 2,000 Minnesotans with long histories of homelessness, and we're also able to demonstrate to DHS the cost-effectiveness of doing that. I went out to Washington, D.C. with the Obama administration. I spent 3 years at the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, and then I spent 4 years in the HUD Secretary's office for both Sean Donovan and Julian Castro. My work there was really broadly at the intersection of housing and health. So, like I said, it's day nine. In the time that I've had with my staff, I had asked really one question to begin, because I've been getting calls from all over the country, including from other housing finance commissioners, and they tell me that I got one of the best ones. And I said, well, what makes us great? And it really comes down to three things. One is that we have an amazing staff that are committed to the mission. Two, we run a tight operation, and I want to thank Commissioner Tengerthal for leaving a house that's in really good working order. But the thing that really makes Minnesota Housing stand out from other housing finance agencies around the country is the partnership that we have with you. For decades, Minnesota Housing and the legislature, on a bipartisan basis, have partnered that allow us to go the extra mile in working on things like reducing homelessness, in working on preservation, in working on the construction of new rental housing, and on filling the home ownership gap, especially for communities of color. So I am looking forward to being your partner. I'm looking forward to exploring the intersectionality between housing and education. You know, if you're moving from school to school to school because you don't have housing stability, you know, how can you learn and what impact does that have on other kids? The intersectionality with health, my background's in healthcare and healthcare finance. You know, we know that when people don't have stable housing, it's really impossible for them to live a healthy life. Criminal justice, there's a great piece on the radio this morning, really about how do we meet the housing needs if we're going to do criminal justice reform. So just as a sidebar, I just want to say, Representative Herr, you're my representative, so look forward to working with you. Representative Gunther, we worked together when I was here a decade ago, looking forward to working together more. And Madam Chair, I'm just very, very excited about this and looking forward to being a good partner to the committee. But since it's day nine, I'm going to let every question go to my very able staff who are here to make a presentation to you.
Yes, because it's day nine for her, we're having several other staff members do the overview of the department, but we are very grateful for your presence, and we know we'll get to know you better.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here. And we have several more members. We just did a brief introduction, so if you would introduce yourself for the record.
Brian Johnson. Representative from 32A, which is close to by San Antonio, Northern Chisago. This is my fourth year.
And we're just joined by one additional person for
introduction. I am a representative from Minneapolis, the new Karen Carr.
And we're joined by two members of Minnesota Housing who are going to give us a brief overview. We assume that this is going to be an ongoing conversation, and you're giving us the broad view this morning. But to begin, if you would please identify yourselves for the record.
Great. Madam Chair, I'm Ryan Baumtrag. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Housing for Policy and Community Development. It's an honor to be here and an honor to work for Minnesota Housing.
And I'm Dan Kitzberg. I'm the Legislative Director for the department, and I really look forward to working with all of you in this role.
Welcome to the committee, and I don't know who's going first.
So we wanted to give a real high-level overview this morning of the work we do at the agency. So to start off with, our mission is that Minnesota Housing is that housing is the foundation for success. So we collaborate with individuals, communities, and partners to create, preserve, and finance affordable housing. Now, we have somewhat of a unique role in relation to other state agencies. We are an independent agency. We were established in 1971. And one of the things that sets us apart from other agencies is we have a 7-member board. And those board members are regionally throughout the state, and they're appointed by the governor. We have an annual independent financial audit and rating agency reviews, and if you have questions about that, I'll defer to Ryan on those. We have no estate appropriations that are used for our agency operating costs. Those all of our operations come from our own internally generated resources. But the state operations we do receive are about 7% or 7 to 10% of our program budget. So before we launch into the overview of the agency itself, I just wanted to provide a few slides of contextual background that may help you understand our work and hopefully help, you know, ground you in some understanding of the work we're going to do together over the next few months. So housing impacts Minnesotans of all backgrounds in all corners of the state. That's the one thing we all have in common is we all need a place to live. Housing touches all areas of our lives, as the commissioner indicated, education, health, jobs, and more. So it's really not a question of whether we should be investing in housing as it relates to these areas, particularly in the state budget. It's a question of how much. So why we're here as a state agency, we're working to make sure that incomes keep pace with rent. So what we want to illustrate with this graph is that beginning in the early 2000s, the gap between what housing costs and what people earn began to grow. And as you'll see, as part of the Great Recession, incomes really bottomed out. But since the recovery, while incomes have grown, the cost of housing has grown as well, to the point where after adjusting for inflation, incomes have actually experienced about a 4% decrease as it relates to the cost of housing. And this is what that distribution looks like throughout the state. This represents households that are cost burdened, so about 250,000 households who are on the lower income, so about $50,000 of area median income, or about $50,000 of annual income and below. You can see that there's quite a bit of concentration around the metro area and then also around regional centers, Moorhead, Mankato, and the Rochester area. We're also here because we need to create equity in home ownership. This graph on the left represents home ownership rates by ethnicity. In Minnesota, we experience one of the highest rates of home ownership enjoyed among white households, while simultaneously households of color experience one of the largest disparities and the lowest rates of home ownership in the country. And on the right, while we've increased our lending to households of color each year, that gap persists. So overall, we do about 35% of our first mortgages to households of color, whereas the market at large does about 14%. We're here to meet the needs of changing demographics. So this chart illustrates the growth we're going to experience over the next couple of decades, broken out by ethnicity. So I draw your attention to the line of white non-Hispanic. The white non-Hispanic population in Minnesota is projected to grow quite slowly overall over the next couple of decades versus other communities who are expected to experience quite rapid growth in that same period of time. And we've noticed the growth is most prevalent in younger populations, so, you know, maybe think Gen Xers and younger than that. Contrast that with rapidly aging, particularly white households in greater Minnesota. These maps show the change that we're going to experience as populations age over time in the next couple of decades. We're also here to support economic growth throughout the entire state. So housing that's affordable to the local workforce supports employers who are growing in their, and are ready to grow. So what this map illustrates is those reddish maroon color dots are areas of the state where there are at least 2,000 jobs and have added about 100 or more jobs over the course of the past year. And then the gray circles, those illustrate where at least 15% of the local workforce commutes 30 miles or more to get to their job. And finally, we're here to end homelessness. So in 2016, we know that over 7,000 Minnesotans experienced homelessness on any given night. But what we hope to illustrate with this graph is that the vertical line illustrates where we began to implement the statewide plan to prevent and end homelessness. So while we are a small and lean agency, as the commissioner alluded to, when we decide to invest in certain populations and focus our efforts and coordinate efforts around specific populations, we make progress. And so it becomes a question of how much progress do you want to make with any given population. And with that, I'll turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Baumtrog.
Mr. Baumtrog, welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Madam Chair. At this time, I wanted to spend a few moments talking about the programs that serve Minnesotans across the state. And to do so, I want to walk through what we call the housing continuum, which really works through the needs all the way from homeless prevention through home ownership. And at Minnesota Housing, we have programs that serve Minnesotans across that continuum and across the state. And I'll share one quick story about a program that you'll hear more about called Homework Starts with Home. Where a family that was homeless received rental assistance that was provided through a state appropriation, and they received rent assistance for 2 years. And after that 2 years, they were able to accrue enough wealth and became a homeowner. So in a matter of 2 years, they went from homeless with two kids to buying their first home in 2 years because of the appropriations that we get from this body. And so I'll take a little time to, given the jurisdiction of the committee, to walk through specifically the state appropriations. Over the rest of the months here, we'll talk more about the larger impact that the agency has, but I wanted to focus on the state appropriations first. So for preventing and ending homelessness, it's been a goal and a priority and a strategic priority of the state, but also of the agency for a number of years. And this is all about housing instability. You're hearing about in the news, people living paycheck to paycheck. We know that about 50% of the lowest income families across the state pay 50% of their income for housing. That makes them very precariously housed and at risk of homelessness. And so the state supports them through the Family Homelessness Prevention and Assistance Program, which provides grants to counties, every county in the state, to address problems and instability in their community. The resources are used for one-time payments if a car breaks down, or also for short-term rent assistance to help stably house that household or that individual so that they don't go into homelessness for an extended period of time.
Representative Munson, was your question to this slide? Or?
No, at the end.
You'll wait. Okay. Continue.
Great. Moving into supportive housing, this is housing stability with support services. So we know that many households across the state need resources to help stabilize their housing situation, and then they need additional services to address other conditions that they have around chemical dependency, mental illness, or other barriers that have either kept them from maintaining housing stability or would keep them from accessing housing should they become homeless. So this is a big focus of our state appropriations. About 50% or around $50 million biannually that we get from the state goes to preventing homelessness and then securing resources for people so that they do not become homeless. So that has been a big focus of the state, given the significant statewide needs for the resources. One thing I'll mention is that with Homework Starts with Home, it was a one-time appropriation we received from the legislature last biennium. There are 8,700 students that experience homelessness across the state in 76 of the counties and in nearly 1,300 school districts. Or 1,300 schools. So it is a statewide issue. It impacts their obviously their housing situation, but impacts their ability to show up to school and then impacts their ability to learn when they're in school if they don't know where they're going to sleep at night. Moving along the continuum, we get into rental housing. We have several programs that are appropriated by the state, both to focus on new construction. You'll hear a little bit later today. The state has not produced enough housing and enough housing at any that supports any incomes and any rent levels. So we'll hear later from the co-chairs of the task force to talk about the need to produce 50% more each year than we're producing in housing. And the only program that Minnesota Housing gets from state appropriations to do that is called the Economic Development and Housing Challenge Program. This supports primarily right now new construction, given the needs across the state and the extremely low vacancies. I'd say about 90% of that program is going into new construction, primarily in greater Minnesota, but also meeting the needs in the metro. You'll see this program come up in home ownership. This is one of our most flexible programs to meet community needs. And if I can take a second, I'd like to honor Representative Gunther, who sits at this table and had the brilliant mind to create this program back in 1999, and it's been serving communities since then and evolving as the needs of households and the needs of communities change over time. We also recently undertook the Greater Minnesota Workforce Development Program. This was a program that first was appropriated in 2016. It focuses on market rate development in Greater Minnesota with a priority towards communities that have a population less than 30,000. And then we've also have a priority for smaller development. We know that many of the communities across the state haven't had new construction of rental in decades. And so the ability to add, with the state support, add 12 units or 24 units in a community really unlocks, we hope unlocks that the market in that community to provide new information and new comps for other investors to get involved in housing in that community. On the preservation side, this has continued to be a focus. It's something the agency spends a lot of time on, and a lot of focus is to maintain the housing that we currently have that's affordable to Minnesotans. The federal government financed a lot of housing in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. That housing is old, but it's in every county, it's in every major city seat in every county, and we need to preserve it. And so these have expiring mortgages or their contracts with the federal government come expiring, and so we use state appropriations to inject capital to improve the building, and then at the same time we work with the owners to then extend the federal contracts to the maximum extent possible to maintain that housing. This is the most cost-effective program that we operate. We're able to add just a couple thousand dollars to each unit, improve it, and then it stays in the community for hopefully another 30 years. The Rental Rehab Loan Program also focuses in Greater Minnesota. We know that much of the housing stock in Greater Minnesota was built decades ago. It's usually in smaller buildings, 1 to 4 units. And there's a real need to preserve that housing. So we use the support from the state to focus on smaller loans to management companies and landlords to improve it and, again, maintain the affordability for years to come. And then finally, for the list of all our programs, ending on home ownership. We know that creating home ownership adds about $10,000 each year in wealth if you're able to achieve home ownership. But we also know that there are multiple barriers to achieving home ownership. So we offer a number of programs to help Minnesotans get into home ownership. And then once they're in home ownership, offer resources to maintain their home and improve their home, especially for seniors across the state who have a fixed income. We offer programs to add accessibility ramps, energy improvements, really health safety programs. I'd be remiss not to mention throughout the slides I've been putting, we put the income levels that we serve. The state appropriations that we get from the legislature allow us to serve the most vulnerable and lowest income Minnesotans. To the commissioner's comments this morning, we could not serve these populations without the resources we get from the state, because the assistance needs to be provided in a way that's most affordable, since many of the households can't afford more higher payments, things that have high interest rates, or as interest rates increase, any more interest rates, the state appropriations allow us to give the most favorable terms at the same time that we're able to provide them as loans, which means if situations change or if they sell their home, that those resources come back to the agency where we're able to re-provide them to Minnesotans. So we take every resource we get from the state with a high level of wanting to give it to those that need it the most, but also understanding that resources are scarce and we want to re-lend those resources to the extent that we can. Here again, you'll see the challenge program. There's a number of activities to support home ownership across the state, including supporting community land trust, improvements to manufactured home parks. The rehabilitation loan program, again, provides loans up to $27,000 and serves the median household income is about $14,000. So really low-income Minnesotans that need to improve their home, because we know likely the next stop for them after their home is a higher-cost facility that isn't likely where they want to be. People want to stay in their home, and that's our main aging-in-place resource that we have. And then I mentioned we get down payment and closing cost assistance from the state, just under $1 million, that helps us serve households and bring the wealth where the wealth doesn't exist, but the income does. And so we see a significant need right now with the market, where home values are going up, interest rates are going up, and that adds to the barriers that make it hard for first-time home buyers to get into the market, and so we're able to support them through our programs. And then we also know that home ownership isn't for everybody, but it's worth looking into, and so we provide resources across the state to do training, pre-purchase counseling, and then post-purchase efforts to support home ownership throughout a household's journey. So our impact is about $1.3 billion is what we're expecting for the next fiscal year, and that's certainly more than what we get from the state, but the state is the catalyst for us to leverage other resources, other private resources particularly. It's larger because we're able to, as a housing finance agency, access capital markets to help support first-time home buyers and also rental developments. And we know the needs are great and much greater than we are able to serve, but we do serve nearly 70,000 households each year. The largest of that chart is Minnesota Housing is the rental assistance contract administrator on behalf of the federal government, and that serves about 28,000 households across the state. That's the biggest portion of that chart that you see in front of you. The other, the second largest is housing stability for vulnerable populations, and that largely is accomplished through the support of the legislature with the programs that I referenced earlier about family homelessness prevention, the Housing Trust Fund, and the Bridges Rental Assistance Program. A little bit about our program delivery. Despite what people maybe think, we don't own or operate any housing. Resources that flow through the agency are accessed by Minnesotans in their community through lenders, through privately owned housing. So we finance the housing and we finance the programs, but it's all locally delivered, and we think that's a key component to Minnesotans accessing the resources through trusted partners in the community, and also allowing us to finance what the needs of the community are, but then let the communities really drive the programs and work with the Minnesotans in their region. As you will hear later, this and heard earlier, the support is critical that we get from the legislature, but we also know that the support is not enough to meet the range and the demand for needs given the increased housing costs and the gap between what households are earning. So one measure that we look at is every year when we combine all of the resources that we get from the state and the federal government into a significant request for proposal, where developers and other parties from across the state apply for our resources. This has been a consistent fact that we are oversubscribed about 3-1 for our most critical resources. So we know the needs are out there. We would like to fund more projects. They are all great projects that will meet local needs and help the households in the area, but currently don't have the resources to keep up with the demand. The other thing is that with the support we get from the state, we leverage significant other resources, philanthropic, local government, private sector resources. So the dollars that we get from the state are amplified because we're able to access other markets. And at this time, we're going to test technology out and bring a video from our recent RFP selections that features the chair.
I'm pleased that we're here at the Jeremiah program today, because I think it helps you see visually. It's a good example of how we leverage state, federal, local, private dollars. They all come together to finish a project like this.
Honestly, we were overwhelmed with surprise and hopeful that was going to occur, but when it occurred, we just couldn't even believe it. It's going to make a huge difference in us moving forward with our project sooner. And there's such a need right now in the Rochester, Southeast Minnesota community for affordable housing.
Like I said, my success is there, so maybe I can give them a better start than, you know, what I had, because not saying my parents didn't do their best, but I think education is, you know, essential to giving them the best start that they can have.
One of the things I want to highlight about that selection that we made last year that will bring new affordable opportunities in Rochester is it's a great example of housing that supports other issues that you're going to hear about throughout session, about the need for child care. So there is on-site child care that will be provided for the single mothers. And so anybody that had to wake up early and drop their kids off, the opportunity to drop your kid off where you live is something that we're interested in and we think is really helpful for success of the households. Just want to end about partnership. We take partnership in everything we do. We could not do nearly what we're able to finance at the state without the support of the legislature and without our partners in the community. So Dan and I look forward to meeting with every one of you, learning about your interests in housing, sharing the investments that the state has made in your communities, and then learning about how else we can support you.
Representative has a question.
Yep. Thank you very much for the presentation. That was very, very informative, and I look forward to being on the committee. I think many of us here have industry experience around housing. You know, I've spent 25 years investing and managing rental properties, And I know we have some real estate agents on here as well. I was a real estate agent off and on for several years. But one of the issues I face with lack of access to affordable housing in my area is the cost of real estate taxes that have increased so much. I had several properties this year that had more than 30% increase in real estate taxes. And I looked at the slide, I think it's slide number 5 on your presentation, that has that chart that shows the 12% increase in rent over the last 18 years, where there's only a 4% increase in income when that's adjusted for inflation. And I'd be curious to know what the average, the real estate taxes have done over that same period. It makes up a large chunk of the rent that tenants are responsible for paying. And I know that we have the rental refund credit in Minnesota, which a lot of tenants, especially those in lower income, can take advantage of. I know that one of the properties I had in Minneapolis, the tenants, because they can get 19% of their rental, of their paid rent back in a rental credit, the tenants collectively on this property received almost 200% of what I had paid in real estate taxes. And that's supposed to be really a credit back on for the real estate taxes that they pay. But there's a lot of people that receive more real estate taxes back than were paid on the property. And I'm wondering if that is if the rental credit is reflected in that rent, or is that just the rent paid? I guess overall, does your organization partner with local cities and towns to address, or advocate for lowering real estate taxes? And then also, I was wondering if you could speak to, the regulations which also burden affordable housing. There's a lot. Every year there's more and more regulations that get attached to what we're required to put into housing. And do you have a program that looks at these additional regulations that are put on builders every year that add to the increase in cost in housing to make housing less affordable, especially for those at the lower income brackets?
I suspect that upcoming meetings we're going to probably revisit several of the things that you referenced. But Mr. Baumtrag, are you prepared to address any?
Madam Chair, I can start with it is the rent paid, so it doesn't take into consideration this is the rent paid by households across the state. I would say that I understand your comments about property taxes. We, as we get applications each year to fund, we understand that these are rental opportunities that need to operate, and they need to operate in an environment. So as costs go up, we're seeing costs go up across the board. I would call out largely construction costs is where we're seeing the biggest growth, just with everything going on, and labor costs. So there are a lot of challenges on costs, and I know that will be part of the conversation going forward, and look forward to that conversation.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I had a question on was kind of going back earlier in the presentation to slide number 11 that was presented to us. Wanted to kind of hit a little bit on definitions there as to the definitions that was being used and some explanations that were being used for defining homelessness. As I first was wondering if they were using the standard federal definition of what homelessness is and I'm seeing heads nodding up now that they're using this federal definition. And then the other thing I wanted to point, one of the things I want to point out on the slide is they were noticing that the source is point in time counts by the Department of HUD. And point in time, could you explain what point in time is and when they're doing those counts?
Mr. Hitzberger?
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, the HUD point in time count happens annually in January. And that happens throughout the state. So this is a kind of a federally coordinated, state-led, volunteer or organizationally driven effort to go out and actually catalog people experiencing homelessness throughout the state. So this is one of the metrics you'll see referred to. Another that you'll see referred to fairly commonly is the Wilder study, which is done every 3 years. And I believe we're expecting results from this past fall's count later on this spring.
And we'll get them on the agenda once those statistics are there, and they'll be fresh and new. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I bring that up, those 2 points up is, number one on the federal definition is they miss a large number of people that are actually homeless. They do not count people who are doubled up. So, example, in the homeless youth environment, it's not unusual for us where we've got kids who've not had a permanent place to be staying for 3, 4, 5 years at a time, but they're never counted as homeless because they're going from, they're doubling up in somebody else's house, and they'll spend a month here, and then they'll go to another house and spend a month there. They're not covered in the federal definition. And the reason I bring that up is Wilder uses a much broader metric is when they take a look at their counts. And to give you an idea of the numbers, if you'll see on the screen there, there's 7,000 that are being mentioned on any given night in the state of Minnesota using federal definitions. When you use Wilder definitions just for homeless youth, they're estimating that at about 6,000 on any given night in the state of Minnesota. So I just want to kind of say, let people know that depending on how we're talking on housing issues, it looks different when you're looking at different statistics and what different definitions are. And I think those are one of the things that we have to recognize in it. And then a question I have is, wondering, at some point we'll be having a presentation as what the demographics are of people who are actually in the homeless population, how that plays out.
We'll make a note of that.
Okay.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson hit on one of the issues I had, and that's the overburdensome state and local regulations that we have. I know of some cities just on the regulation side, just whack and sack is $10,000 a house or more. That's to hook up water and sewer to the system. That's $10,000 added to the cost of a home. But for the testifiers, one of the questions I have, in 2008, we had the housing bubble. I had the misfortune of being the deputy sheriff that had to do foreclosure on all these homes. Some of the homes, I didn't feel sorry for the people because I'd walk in there, they hadn't paid a dime on their mortgage for 6-8 months, and you look around, you see 2 new vehicles, 3 snowmobiles, brand new boat. They're paying on those things, but not paying on their home. So I didn't feel sorry for them. But we did have a few that I did feel sorry for, but they are victims of the circumstances, not because they couldn't afford their home, but because of other issues that came up. It could have been medical, it could have been something else. But in 2008, we had that huge bubble burst of the housing market. We had way more homes available than we had people to purchase them. We had people out building 20, 30 spec homes. Banks were, because of federal regulations, banks were giving money out like candy. And it caused a huge issue with our economy. The housing bubble was the main reason we had this huge recession. After that, they finally did some federal rule changes on the banking industry. And you mentioned it's only 14% of the banks are doing some of the first-time home buyer. My question is, how much is that low rate stuff that the private banks are doing is because of the federal regulations and the requirements that they have because the federal government's concerned about another housing bubble?
Mr. Baumtrag, I don't know if that's within your purview or...
Madam Chair, I can. I don't know the answer to your question that you're asking at the end, but I will say about Minnesota Housing's first-time home buyers, we require a minimum credit score of 640. They have to take training or counseling before getting into it, and they have to put money down onto the home. Our delinquency rates, looking at 30, 60 days, are often better than other lenders, so I can't speak to other lenders, but I can say that we understand concerns about that and take that into concern. I would also say that, you know, going back to 2008, there was a lot of predatory actions and predatory lenders, and most of that has been cleaned up, but certainly seen potentially some more of that. So we're looking at that.
We have 2 more questions, and then we're going to have to move on because we have 4 more speakers. And so Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not really sure, you know, answer what you think you can, and some of it's probably just going to be comments. But I have several questions. I've got a 30-plus year of working in experience working in building and housing and remodeling. And when the housing bubble hit, the recession hit, we actually got back into rentals after not being in rentals for a while, just to have something to do. We were up to 13 at one time, and since we've kind of decided to lay a little bit lower, and now we are up to 5. So I have several questions, and one is, in our community in St. Cloud, we have a need for larger rental spaces because of larger families. So is that something that you are all looking at as well? Are there ways to incentivize to get some larger spaces available? Now, we just do single-family homes, and it's tough to find anything over 4 bedrooms. It truly is, but yet there's a need for it. So are we looking at some of those possibilities? And also, we've had several renters that are looking to rent to own, but obviously their credit is bad. But what we understand is that we have to own the house free and clear before we can offer those opportunities to do a rent and rent to own. So my question is, would there be any work that we could do to see if it would be possible for folks who want to own the home, even though we don't own the home free and clear? Another is, are there any education programs for folks that are going into rentals? We do take Section 8, and we have several folks that have been with us for a long time, and quite frankly, some of them say they'll be with us until the end of time. But it would keep costs down if they had a better understanding of how a home runs. And that means basically just, you know, letting us know when things break, and also cleaning or changing furnace filters. Just simple things like that that you do when you own a home. And that would help keep some of the costs down as well. But it would also prepare them, if they want to get into a home, to know how do they take care of that home. We see that a lot. And we work with a lot of the families to say, hey, let us know what you need, how we can help, but you can help me by checking furnace filters, doing things like that as well. And my favorite is when we talk about mandates and codes. A gentleman in my area recently built a wonderful housing, multifamily housing unit. He had $1 million in permit fees before a shovel hit the ground. We can't do affordable housing when we look at some of those things. And hopefully I might see him today. And my question to him is, can I have a breakdown of what those fees are so that we can look at some of them and say, do we really need to do this? One of the complaints in the building and remodeling industry we have is all the duplicative permitting that happens. You know, you're going to different agencies for the same thing. But when we want to do affordable housing, it's just so hard when you've got $1 million in permit fees before you even start an apartment complex. So that perhaps is my favorite, and that's what I'm hoping we look at a lot, is how do we make it affordable before we even put a shovel in the ground.
And we do have some upcoming meetings where we'll be going back to a number of those points that she raised, but I don't want to cut you up too much, but if just briefly, if you have
Madam Chair, I'll be very brief, and then would love to sit down and chat with you more about several issues. One thing to say is that we do focus on large families. That is a priority in our application process, and often in new construction, we are the only one that's building 3 and 4 bedrooms. Usually the market responds with 1s and 2 bedrooms, and with state resources, we think it's important to do large families. Love to talk about rent-to-own with you. There are organizations that, such as Housing Link and other, that do certification programs for renters. We also, for first-time home buyers, again, require home ownership training to get into issues like that. And then I know after I'm done talking, you're going to hear about the task force and one of the things that came up in there, because we heard a lot about cost and barriers and codes, and there was a recommendation to evaluate those and look at those, and we're interested in that.
Representative Howard has the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question about preservation, and noted in the presentation that some of the resources directed there are about the most cost-effective. And preservation is an issue very important to our community in Richfield and Bloomington. In recent years, we saw a mass displacement of over 1,000 families, including over 100 students in Richfield, when a naturally occurring affordable housing multi-tenant unit was purchased. Rents were raised, rental requirements were changed, and about 96% of folks were displaced. And so when you look at preservation and this battle of more or less affordable housing, preservation seems vital. And noted in some of the resources, it would appear that preservation energies through the Minnesota Housing helped current owners of NOAA properties update their facilities, et cetera. Is there crossover or work in terms of pursuing the purchase of facilities, NOAA properties in intersection with housing? Because that is a big forefront as well. So just wanted to raise that issue up.
Sure. Madam Chair.
NOAA properties being naturally occurring affordable housing.
Yes, Madam Chair, and that is an issue that we care about. Our state appropriations don't address that issue, but we do use other agency resources to help others who are interested in purchasing those properties. And we do know that statewide we're losing about 2,000 units that are naturally occurring each year, where they convert and their rehab is done and rents go up, and in some markets displacing a lot of low-income and largely minority households.
Thank you for starting our conversation. There is so much more. We know we'll have you back, I'm sure. Now we're going to hear from co-chairs of a governor's task force on housing, and they can come forward to the table. And because it's complicated, you've begun to get some sense of it in the questions and the presentation from Minnesota Housing. The Governor's Task Force on Housing was formed, representatives from all over the state and all sectors, and spent about a year in studying this. And when the press conference was there to roll out the report, one of the reporters' questions was, what did you learn, something that was new? And I think the assumption behind the question was, you must have in this year, those of you on this task force, learned one thing. And if we just do that one thing, we'll solve some problems. But I think what the task force found was just the opposite, yeah. And that is it's complicated. And we'll get a little sense of that this morning. Please, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourselves for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jean Crane, President and CEO of Bremer Financial Corporation.
Good morning. My name is Akua Ellis, and I'm Senior Vice President of Community Impact for the Greater Twin Cities United Way.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So I know that...
Is Alice first?
Yes. I know we've got some other folks following us, so we'll move expeditiously through this and take questions at the end if there are any.
And you have two items in your folder.
Okay. So as was mentioned, my name is Akua, and in my day job, I have the opportunity to serve as Senior Vice President of Community Impact for Greater Twin Cities United Way. At the time that I was... invited to participate in the task force, I was really actively lobbying for dollars, particularly bonding, for the completion of the Dorothy Day Place project. And so saw an awesome opportunity to bring to the forefront and elevate the visibility of an issue that is statewide in its nature and really build the political will for us to do more as a state. Moving to the next slide. Take turns driving.
Sure.
All right. So, as was mentioned, this body was envisioned and convened as a diverse group, which represented multiple sectors, so nonprofit leaders, community advocates, builders, major employers, as well as officials from various levels of government were participating. We had representation from both major political parties, including the two people on this very committee who served with us on the task force, so Chair Hausman and Representative Gunther. All regions of the state were also represented in this body. As you might imagine, this was a pretty intense effort with a short window to work through a very complex challenge. There were three working groups, one focused on housing stability and opportunity, so think the supports that maintain stable housing, home ownership, and then rental housing. And then each of those called upon experts with both professional and lived experience and dug deep into available analysis and data. Our meetings were open to the public, both in person and via the internet. And for anyone who's interested in seeing all the content that was shared, you can go to mnhousingtaskforce.com and see minutes from the meetings, or not meeting minutes from the meetings, but you can see video from the meeting as well as the materials that were presented for additional background, although it sounds like there's a lot of expertise around this table. Task force members, not surprisingly, didn't always agree. In fact, there were several recommendations in the report that were intensely negotiated. And what you'll see in the report is a reflection of a true workable compromise and position among those stakeholders. I'm really proud of where we landed together. So we held 8 forums across the state, and hundreds of folks attended. We were in Austin, Crookston, Duluth, Golden Valley, Little Falls, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Sleepy Eye. It kind of sounds like I've been everywhere. So it was an awesome opportunity for us to hear from folks directly who were impacted, experiencing, navigating housing challenges in their communities. What struck me was how tight the market was outside of the city. So as someone who's been a housing advocate for a number of years, I'm very familiar with the challenges in the Twin Cities. But in some areas of the state, which my co-chair will share a bit more about, we saw even more profound challenges with the housing shortage. In Sleepy Eye, for instance, I met a woman whose family had experienced homelessness despite gainful employment, because you literally had to know someone to find available housing, and they were new in town, so it took them time to meet folks and learn of available units. In other parts of the state, there were folks who expressed fear of the unknown neighbor in some instances, or feared displacement, and so support for new construction was challenged, and that left hundreds of job vacancies for a major regional employer. In the Twin Cities, we heard a great deal about the impact of a swift eviction process with compounding effects in a tight housing market.
So we anchored our recommendations with the final report with a clear vision, and I think it's important to read this out loud. So the vision is: every Minnesotan has a place to live in a thriving community, and livability remains a hallmark and competitive advantage for our state. Through collaboration, creativity, and effective investments, we build Minnesota's future together and share in its prosperity. So we all understood, as we worked through the task force and went to all these various communities, that the needs of the communities, the regions, really are unique and do require tailored situations throughout. And that, I think, a lot of that work was captured by the work of the task force as we made these visits. But it's cleared that we all have a role to do this together, because it isn't any one entity, one sector, that will solve the complexity of this really big issue. So the ability of our state to succeed and prosper does rest on the foundation of citizens who have stable homes. That was really the conclusion. And from that foundation, all the goals, I think, that we want to aspire to, and that includes good education for kids, a prosperous workforce, improved health outcomes, meaningful access to overall a variety of opportunities, that all becomes easier to achieve when you have stability of homes. So this isn't in the interest of just one group or in one income earner category or one region. All the success, what we determine, is really very much intertwined. So in the end, we came up with 6 goals. This led to this work that, taken together, this was really the roadmap that we developed to tackle this issue of affordable housing. And under each of these 6 major goals are 30 recommendations, and each of those goes into the details of how to make this actionable, which was really a critical outcome of the work, was not just to identify and be, speak to, initiatives that really didn't allow real action and real impact in terms of what we had discovered. So, and the exciting thing is that many activities are already underway to create impact. So we want to take a moment to talk through each goal with you today, and I'll just walk through quickly the 6 goals to name them, and then we will go through them. The first is commit to homes as a priority, preserve the homes that we have, build more homes, increase home stability, link homes and services, and support and strengthen home ownership. So the first is commit to homes as a priority. And so first and foremost, we believe that it is critical that all of us come together to acknowledge and commit to the centrality of affordable and attainable homes for Minnesota's future. And this was one of those discoveries that we are losing a competitive advantage that has always been a hallmark of our state. This means that we have to devote attention and resources as needed across all sectors to achieve this particular goal. We have already seen some great progress here. There's been really fabulous news coverage, a lot of public attention, and not just the task force, but to this overall issue, which continues to resonate across the state, particularly at many local levels. And a new effort, Prosperity's Front Door, which you will all hear about more shortly, that's also been created to help coordinate and bring together greater awareness to work toward solving these issues, and it's really done to spur on the whole housing issue altogether. Personally, I've been able to be a part of this substantive examples of where public-private partnership has really helped move this issue forward in a number of ways. So as an example, at Bremer, what we have done most recently in the last year and a half is get involved with Habitat for Humanity, and simply what our involvement there is to commit to buying 500 below-rate mortgage housing units in order to create affordability for people to get into homes. What we love about that partnership is that the work that Habitat does in particular, and this is already mentioned by some of the questions that have come up by the committee, is they know how to create really successful home owners. We have the capital to provide the opportunity to create those mortgages, and the success of those home owners in being prepared for owning those homes, understanding what it takes to maintain and be stable in that home environment, is really what led us to be interested in that public-private partnership. Also, the Itasca group, which is how I personally got involved with this work, you know, Itasca really discovered along the way that it was really a consideration for all businesses in the private sector to be concerned about and be at least educated about this issue of housing affordability, because it becomes a workforce issue and it becomes an economic viability issue of the, you know, again, this hallmark of our competitiveness as a state. And if you can't house people, you can't attract workforce, you can't expand here, you run into roadblocks, you look at businesses making different types of decisions because of this particular issue. We think we have a chance to be innovative on this front, and Itasca also is taking work forward now, developing their own housing task force within Itasca. And that's all about, again, engaging business leaders and really creating an awareness and an action for involvement as well on that front. So we're very excited about some of the work that continues and the understanding what it takes to get a lot of folks involved in this initiative going forward. Yeah.
And I think I'm going to have to encourage you to move very quickly because we do want to get to Prosperity's Front Door, too.
Yes, and I can talk very quickly. So the next recommendation is to preserve the homes that we have. So we know that one of the most cost-effective ways to provide homes that are affordable for Minnesotans is for us to maintain and preserve the homes and apartments that we already have. The majority of affordably priced homes in this state are modest, older homes and apartments available in the private market. As we've mentioned before, we call those units NOAA. And every year, an additional 2,000 once affordable homes are either torn down or upscaled and priced out of range for many Minnesotans. New investments in rehab funds, which allow homeowners earning modest wages and community-minded apartment owners to keep properties in good condition at affordable prices, would enable us to maintain more of this vital housing stock and at just a fraction of what it takes to build a new unit. To give one example, we recommended that the State Housing Agency work with local government to develop a set of financing and regulatory incentives designed to encourage ownership of these naturally occurring affordable units, and look into how potential changes and expansion of the 4D property tax classification could provide a viable incentive. And I think that speaks to one of the points that was made earlier today.
The next is build more homes. And again, the task force has estimated that we are 52,000 homes short of what we need right now at this very moment. And after the financial crisis, building slowed dramatically. We all witnessed that personally. And in 2009, we built one quarter of what we had built in 2004. So right now, despite the, you know, a lot of the work that you might see going on in different neighborhoods, we're still building less than 60% of what we were at peak. And so we're just not keeping up generally with the need overall. In the community forums, we heard stories of families who had moved to Minnesota with a new job and only to find themselves in a hotel for 6 months because they could not find a place to live. A healthy, balanced market would have 5 months' inventory of homes for sale and roughly a 5% vacancy in the rental market. We're well below both of those statistics right now, and prices have steadily increased in response. Greater Minnesota currently has the lowest vacancy rates we've seen since 2000. And in the metro area, some markets are under a 1% vacancy rate. So housing is not simply a demand and supply story either. So that's another point I really think is critical to make. The real cost to build a home has also increased. This was also brought up by the committee already. And so without public investment, it will be very difficult to build new homes that will work for the budgets of low-income families in Minnesota. However, addressing the supply and demand dynamics is the critical first step to stabilizing the market and getting ahead of this tightening market that affects absolutely everyone in our state. We can also begin to do things differently to get ahead, and the task force recommended investments in developing a modern construction workforce, ways to pursue innovative in design. I think Minnesota has a great opportunity to be a leader in that regard, in building and financing and really the assessment of regulatory changes needed to enable many of these breakthrough strategies.
All right, so increasing home stability. Stable homes are essential for families to thrive and fully participate in their communities. And in order to address this, we recommended interventions to meet a variety of needs. As you can see on the screen, we've endorsed the Heading Home Together plan, including the investments and state actions that it requires to move us towards preventing and ending homelessness. Right now, at least 7,600 Minnesotans experience homelessness on any given night, and this is simply not acceptable. We are making some progress, however, with a 27% decrease in chronic homelessness since 2014. This is the result of intentional effort and collaboration, and we've got to be intentional about maintaining that momentum. We also made several recommendations to improve stability for low-income renters. This was an area where we brought together tenants' rights activists like the Housing Justice Center and landlords such as the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association toward recommendations which include realistic steps to meet the needs of tenants and property owners in the state, such as flexible emergency resources, strengthen tenant protections, improve notice of sale ordinances, and inspection systems that are designed to crack down on predatory landlords.
The next goal was to link homes and services. And so you may create a lot of homes, but you have to make sure that you can keep people in those homes, right? And so most Minnesotans will need services in their homes at some point during their lives. And an estimated 70% of people who are 65 or older will need long-term care related to daily living at some point. And research shows that when we deliver those services in people's homes, health outcomes and social incomes both improve. This is also a more cost-effective strategy, clearly, and the Wilder Foundation has partnered with Minnesota Housing to look at what it would to look at what it took to allow seniors at age in place and have an effective home services. And that is less than half the cost of going into a nursing home facility. So perhaps even more importantly, this is also what people overwhelmingly say they prefer. These principles don't apply just to seniors, of course. There's greater coordination that can help these living, those living with disabilities, people who have experienced some kind of trauma, and those transitioning out of other systems, such as foster care or even our Minnesota veterans who are returning home from service.
And the last goal.
All right, so supporting and strengthening home ownership. Home equity accounts for 68% of the median net worth for American families. And you heard earlier from our colleagues in Minnesota Housing Finance Agency that is an opportunity that is not proportionally offered to our community.
As you can see on the screen, there are many households of color who have the income to purchase and maintain a home but remain locked out of home ownership. So one example that came to us in the very first meeting of the task force was from Mariah, a resident of Crossroads, and a former resident of the Crossroads Apartments in Richfield that was displaced when it became concierge. Because she had received insufficient notice that she needed to find a home, it didn't provide enough time to initiate the financing and the actual identification of a home, although her income would support a mortgage. Each application that she made in order to try to find a new unit for her family required a credit check, and each credit check was a hard ding on her credit record, which meant that not only was she in a rental unit that was more than affordable, so more than 30% of her annual income, but also she had come into that unit with a significantly impacted credit score, which made the opportunity for home ownership further out of reach for her. So you can just kind of see how these things snowball and work together. We need homes and apartments that meet all family types and income levels, and this will require commitment, collaboration, and creativity.
Are we moving on now to?
You know what? We can go ahead and move on if there are questions, or we can turn it over to Warren and Ellen from Prosperity's Front Door.
I think maybe it looks like we're ready to talk about Prosperity's Front Door.
Okay.
Because we didn't want this to just be a report that people spend a year working on and then it goes on a shelf somewhere.
Absolutely.
There's a new organization called Prosperity's Front Door. Two members of that group, introduce themselves as they come forward.
Awesome. Thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you very much. I know we're going to be revisiting this for at subsequent meetings, and so we'll go back to those recommendations on a regular basis.
Wonderful.
Thank you for your work.
Madam Chair, I do have a couple of questions for these testifiers.
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourselves for the record.
Sure. My name is Warren Hansen. I'm the president of Greater Minnesota Housing Fund.
Good morning. I'm Ellen Sally. I'm president of the Family Housing Fund.
And we are speeding ahead there to the right slide. Thank you, members and Madam Chair. We will be brief. We realize the time is limited. We want to highlight for you the organization and network known as Prosperity's Front Door. Sometimes we refer to this as Phase 2 of the Governor's Housing Task Force, but the purpose of Prosperity's Front Door is really to create a growing network of civic and business leaders throughout Minnesota that will help raise awareness and understanding of the critical need for housing of all types as an issue that is critical to our economic competitiveness, as Jean Crane and Akua Ellis mentioned. We're very excited to be here to address the committee, and we want to highlight that we're very aware that you're going to be hearing a lot of proposals during the session, and we would just suggest that this session, this is maybe not brand new, but that this session, especially for new members, to look at the issue of housing and the adequate supply of housing for all Minnesotans as a economic competitiveness issue for the state of Minnesota, and an issue or a concern that puts our state's economy and the economy of local communities at risk if we don't address this issue.
So we started with the framework of the Minnesota Task Force on Housing to create and launch Prosperity's Front Door. And it was specifically set up to ensure that those recommendations didn't sit on the shelf but became an active part of all of our work to advance them. So Prosperity's Front Door is building this network of civic leaders, housing providers, elected officials at all levels to advance a number of goals. And specifically, we intend to expand the network of stakeholders for housing solutions. We intend to identify leaders to advance the specific recommendations of the task force. advocate for actionable solutions across all sectors and at all levels, and amplify the good work of the partners that you'll hear from undoubtedly throughout the session who are doing really good work on housing already. So we are not intending to compete with those efforts, but rather complement each other and further advance and multiply that impact. And our goal is really to bring more voices to the table. You heard Gina Nakua talk about the messages that we heard across the state from business leaders, for example. They haven't been traditionally seen as housing advocates. How do we incorporate what their experience to work together towards solutions that really create sustainable impact for our state?
So we are promoting a growing awareness of some of the facts that really drive the housing need, and some of those have been mentioned. But just really briefly, one of the more astounding considerations that we're witnessing right now, all of us are seeing this in the marketplace, is that the price of housing, the cost of a home, is going up dramatically. Last year in the Twin Cities, it went up by almost 7%. This year, it's projected to go up by another 9%. Meanwhile, real incomes in Minnesota, adjusted for inflation over the last decade, have gone down by 7%. So we have this growing disparity between what's going on with incomes and income growth, or lack of income growth, and the kind of the hyper growth in the cost of housing and the price of homes. So again, this is really goes to economic competitiveness and increasing the supply, because much of this can be addressed through increasing the supply and addressing the 52,000 unit shortage that we have right now. And as I'll talk about later, there are some other innovation areas and recommendations that came out of the task force having to do with regulation reform and so forth that will address the issue if we coordinate all of these efforts.
So Gina Nakula spoke about the governor's task force work and chatting and visiting with communities across the state. One of the things that Prosperity's Front Door did after the report was delivered and the task force work was done is spend time going throughout the state as well, talking specifically about the recommendations, making it real for citizens across the state about what they could do, what we could do together to address the housing challenge. And so some of the things that we heard was consistently housing is an issue for every community, but it looks different in every community and how they experience and what they're able to do to tackle that challenge. But we've heard from business leaders who this is impacting their ability to hire and grow, and we all know that that is an important part of keeping our state's fiscal health. We understood and heard from families who had to choose between leaving their community because they couldn't find housing. And these are communities that have been long called home for our families, and to think about what that disruption meant for their communities of faith and their children in school. And we heard from elected officials, very much like you probably have, that this is an issue that guides everyone's work on a day-to-day basis and struggling with what those solutions are. So part of our goal with Prosperity's Front Door is to elevate the conversation, build the public will, and drive towards the kinds of solutions that can be impactful for all those issues.
Two things. One is that while we're talking about economic competitiveness, and we all tend to think about economic development, job growth, and employment, which I'll talk about a couple of examples there, we're also talking about social outcomes and the importance of housing to achieve adequate health, adequate educational achievement, and just hold a job or have employment stability. So those kinds of outcomes also affect our economy. They're indirect, but they're very, very profoundly affected by the supply of stable housing. But back to employers, when we traveled the state as sort of this phase two work to reach out to the business community and chambers and so forth, we spent time in Thief River Falls with DigiKey, which is right now trying to add, has plans, you've seen it in the newspaper, I'm sure, to add 1,000 jobs over the next 5 years. They can't do that at the speed that they want to, and they may not be able to do it completely because of a lack of housing supply in Thief River Falls and Pennington County area. We also have spent time in St. Cloud with CentraCare, which is growing tremendously, 14,000 employees. Their employees are having difficulty in the central region finding a housing, adequate housing supply. and it's a barrier to their growth. In the metro, of course, we've talked about NOAA in Richfield and the loss of NOAA housing throughout the metro and statewide. And in Rochester, one of the more profound examples of this job growth and housing supply demand is with the DMC and the plans that the DMC has to add 40,000 jobs over the next 10 years. And how important that is to the entire state economy as a global organization that is really something that is critical to the Olmsted County area, but also to the whole state. So every community in Minnesota, these are just examples that many of you know about or they're local in your communities, but every community around the state is experiencing some type of housing shortage right now. Oh, I'm the next guy. Okay. So what are the solutions? And as you'll see on this next slide on the screen and in your packet, what we have focused on with Prosperity's Front Door are three main buckets or categories of work. One is lowering cost. Now, this can be done in part through addressing certain regulatory barriers that exist. And improving the efficiency of government and focusing on making housing accessible at every income level. Removing some of these roadblocks will reduce production costs and help us achieve this 10,000 unit per year increase over and above what we currently produce in Minnesota. So we all have to work together. Local government and state government needs to work on lowering costs and regulatory reform. Another area that we think has great potential and somewhat of a holy grail is innovation in the area of using new building technologies and new creative financing methods. And great things are being done in both of those categories, including possibly the use of more logistics expertise and ways to better train and employ our construction and building trade talent. But we do have a shortage in labor as well and need innovation in that area to attract the talent that we need to produce the housing. And the last one is public and private resources. There is a great demand for greater investment in housing of all types. We often think of it, the first thing that comes to mind, especially for the members in the room here, is government resources at the state level and at the local level, as those can be leveraged. But also we have a great philanthropic community in Minnesota, and we're very fortunate to have the foundation community that takes housing as a key area of interest. And then there's the private sector. Employers have invested in affordable housing. We can call on the banks to invest further and partner with us in some new ways. So all of those three areas are the areas that the Prosperity's Front Door is going to focus on during the next year and a half, 2 years.
So just two slides in closing. The investing in housing isn't only a benefit to housing sector alone, and this slide highlights some of the other impacts in related construction jobs and others. But building off a point that Commissioner Ho mentioned in her introduction, investing in housing and creating housing options also helps us to achieve other policy objectives that are essential, again, for our state to continue to thrive, and is made more difficult without housing. So we can reduce childhood poverty. We can reduce and eliminate racial disparities. We can create jobs. We can improve educational outcomes. But all that happens from the platform of housing. And so as you're considering other pressing state business on those, keep in mind that housing is a critical part of those goals that you might set in your work moving forward. And it's also important to recognize that there is no silver bullet, no magic wand that solves any public policy problem, and housing is particularly complicated. So I think the task force recommendations highlight the any number of strategies that can work and we should be tackling. So don't look for one example alone, but rather a whole tool in our toolbox to tackle this problem in a creative way, and how it intersects with some of these other priorities that you will undoubtedly grapple with in this legislative session. So our future really depends on achieving broader housing options for the Minnesotans here. And this commitment, this committee and the legislature must take action to preserve and expand housing options for all types. Right now, housing is a competitive advantage for Minnesota. We are not yet saddled with the problems like San Francisco or Seattle that are struggling with housing for workforce and people who have lived in those communities for a long time. However, we can't really rest on our laurels. And when you look at any of the data, it shows that our housing landscape is changing, and we've got to do something to intervene so that we can maintain that competitive advantage. And thus, housing solutions are, quite frankly, in our reach. So part of what we're doing through Prosperity's Front Door is really, again, those 4 points: expanding the network of people who are invested in solutions, identifying leaders to specifically advance recommendations that came from the task force that Gina Nakua spoke about, advocating for actionable solutions at all levels of government, not just here, but in local units of government and counties as well, and amplifying the work of our partners who have been tackling this and have been at this in front of you for a number of years now as well. So I want to thank you on behalf of Warren, and I thank you for the opportunity to appear in front of you, and thank you for your commitment and your work ahead of you in this session.
Representative Johnson, are you able to address your question to them, or should we have Ms. Ellis back to the table?
I guess either group could actually answer this
question.
Well,
maybe ask the question and see if they can respond. Otherwise, we'll ask Ms. Ellis to come back.
The housing issue is very complicated. Mm-hmm. It's usually, when somebody buys their home, it's usually the largest investment they ever do. And it's not just for right now. It's an investment in their future. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, it's their investment for when they unfortunately end up go into assisted living. When they buy the house, when they buy a home, it's an investment that's going to grow. In order for that investment to grow, the value has to increase. But what we're dealing here is an issue that's pulling and fighting at both ends. We want the value of the homes to increase, but we want the to be affordable. As the your group or the task force taken that into consideration as a way to work things out? And then the other issue I had with the statement that was made that we're only at 25% of what we were in our peak production? In our peak?
50%. Yeah.
Or 50%. At our peak, we were overbuilding at a rate
exactly
that caused the economy to crash. Sure. We do not want to be there. Mm-hmm. Each area of the state is a little different. In my area, we finally caught up after 8 years before we started building houses again. The market was flooded. We cannot have that happen again, or it is going to really hurt this great state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, I would say that the task force and Prosperity's Front Door is, and I think the agency and all of us working in housing, are very aware of how important it is to have a healthy housing market, which means having equilibrium. And that would suggest, obviously, we don't overbuild, we don't undersupply. But when we achieve a certain stasis, I guess, where we have adequate supply and home values can increase at their normal rate of 3% a year, not 10-15% a year, where it becomes unaffordable for the next buyer, and we have a healthy vacancy rate, not overbuilding and having, you know, bankruptcies with apartment buildings and so forth, but having that healthy vacancy rate and healthy for sale supply and appreciation, then we have achieved our goal. But things are quite out of sync right now in both senses.
Thank you.
Not everywhere.
Thank you very much for your work. Members, we will revisit both the department's mission and Prosperity's Front Door and the task force throughout the session. And we'll keep reminding ourselves of some of the goals and recommendations. And so you've started the conversation, but we're going to be constantly going back to what we've heard from you today.
Thank you.
So lots of questions, but lots of work to do. But our time is up today. Meeting is adjourned.